This edition of Radio Curious is a conversation with Representative Sam Farr from the 17th Congressional District, which is Monterey and Santa Cruz counties in the Central Coast of California. Congressman Farr and I last spoke the day that President Obama was inaugurated. We'll talk about the differences between then and now and what's going on in the nation's capital. This interview, which was recorded on April 3rd, 2011, began when I asked him what happened between President Obama's election and now.
We had an election. We had a revolution in America. The old John Birch Society took over, now called the Tea Party, but essentially the same tenets as the old John Birch Society. Sort of get government out of the UN, get government out of our lives, get government, just get government out of everything except military. We can't do that by the private sector, although everything we buy has to be made by the private sector. So it's a whole different philosophy. And brought on by people who haven't really had any experience, because 33 of the new members have never been in public office, so they don't know how a school district runs, or a city, or a special district, or a county, or a legislature, or anything like that, which most people, before getting elected to Congress, have in one way or another served in some local office.
So how is that different? How is this Congress different from all other Congresses?
Well, I think it's the least prepared to handle the most complicated jobs right now, global jobs and domestic jobs. Issues, not just jobs, but they all are related to jobs. But it is essentially a group of people who don't like government and don't really want to learn how it works because they don't like it, the idea that it even exists. And it's very frustrating when you hear their questions. My grandchildren can ask more intelligent questions than I've heard from a lot of these new freshmen.
What are some of the things that they ask?
Well, why don't you tell us how we should cut your budget by 25%, 50%? You know, I like to remind them that they're before us because we set their budgets, and they're carrying out programs that Congress has created. They're administering the laws pursuant to the way we wrote them. So if you don't like the laws, then you as a member of Congress need to know how they work and how you want to change them. And you, the member of Congress, if you don't like the way a project's funded, need to know how to realign that funding. But it's sort of asking somebody who's begging you for money, how can you live with less than what you're even begging for?
So those people are going to be there for at least another 22 months. What do you foresee occurring in relationship to the election of the next Congress, the election of or re-election of President Obama, and what will happen in the Senate? What trend do you see going on in the United States?
I think it's too early to know from the trends. We're only into our end of our third month and beginning our fourth month, and so far the Republican-dominated House has done some pretty draconian things in passing bills that cut billions and billions of dollars more than the system can absorb. I mean, most people will tell you, if you're going to do a draconian cut of my department, give me some time so that I can make arrangements so that the safety nets aren't ruined. Because if you give me a short-term fuse, all I can do is lay off people.
Radio Curious is broadcast on public radio and on a few commercial radio stations. There was a lot of talk not too long ago about defunding National Public Radio. How did that work? It's linked to the continuing resolution, as I understand it, to keep the government from going out of business or stopping till funding is passed.
Well, Congress doesn't fund radio per se. It funds the Public Broadcasting Corporation, which in turn funds programs like NPR and other public radio and public television programs, and provides money and in essence subsidies for rural areas that don't have the constituent or consumer base that can run a station just on donations alone. The urban areas will survive, but the rural areas will lose their access to that kind of a media. And both the television and radio with these kind of cuts.
So then the frequencies would remain open, but they could be picked up by somebody else if a public radio station were to close.
Yeah, there may be some intent to do that. I think there's an awful lot of criticism on the right of public media because they're so popular now. I mean, I think NPR is the most listened to radio network in the country and is growing exponentially every year because it's great stuff. It's very informative and very educational. And I'm a big fan. I mean, the radio here I am, you know, in Washington talking to you, and you can record this conversation. If I were doing this by television, you'd have to go to a studio and do it, and somebody at the other end would have to be turning on a television set to watch it. And what I love about radio is it's hands-free. It's the background. It's, you can be doing a lot of other things while you're listening to the radio. You can't be doing a lot of other things when you're on the computer or when you're watching the tube. So it's, to me, the best media source there is because it's so easy to use and to be used so effectively with the way we have designed this system in the United States. I mean, we need this democracy that we brag about, the basic tenets are that you have to have a well-informed electorate. And I think what we're finding from the last elections is that we're having a lesser informed electorate, and there are consequences to the votes cast. And what we see is a new group of people in Congress who don't really want to learn how government operates and learn how to make it run better. They just don't like government and don't want it to run better or worse. They just don't want it at all.
In your observation, being a member of Congress, do you see any similar rhetoric? The 33 members that you talk about, first-time office holders of any office, I presume come from many different parts of the country. Is there a philosophy or a rhetoric that is similar among all of those members beyond let's have no government?
No, because they've never worked on a team before. It's, you know, part of being elected to office is you're just one member of a team, and you've got to put together a majority of that team to make a decision. And you usually try to make the decision, which is always compromised from where it started, and you develop your knowledge of the issue by having hearings and getting informed both by the hearing process and by what people do in petitioning their government by mail and email and so on, visits. I mean, everything's a kind of a learning curve, right? And when you feel appropriately familiar with the subject matter, then you're willing to act on it, mark up a bill, and vote on it. But we're not even having hearings on this budget stuff. I'm on the committee. I'm on the Appropriations Committee. This is an appropriations bill that passed H.R. 1 that cut $60 billion out of this year's budget, not next year's, just this year's. And you're halfway through our fiscal year.
How will those budget cuts of $60 million affect the people in California?
Well, every way possible. Obviously, you've already heard a small part of it is NPR radio, but it's also all family planning. They're against it. It's, you know, we don't use any public money to pay for abortion, but it's not the abortion issue anymore. It's now education about family planning that they're against, and they're cutting that out. And it cuts out, for example, across the boards in Department of Agriculture, and we're trying to point out to them, we slaughter 12 billion chickens a year and 157 million steers, and those are all, it's all production line. And this will be a vegetarian's dream, but you would totally, without meat, you can't slaughter any of those without a meat inspector. Those are federally licensed personnel. And it would just bring to a halt, and all of the people that grow the grain and haul those things to market and deliver them on the other end and sell them abroad and all that, it would come to a complete stop. So you would really disrupt the economy. And I think it's a good question you asked, Barry, because I think where we have failed in government and private sector too is to have the private sector really analyze, where do I need government? If you're walking around with a license as a lawyer, as you are, or a doctor, you need a license from the government to show that you're professional and meet the criteria. If you're a truck driver, you need a license from government. You need that truck inspected. You need all those things. I mean, government, you cannot have a successful business without having your partner in business, which is the government side. And that argues for one, professional, that there is a professional ability out there, and two, for an equal playing field. So we do set the standards and regulations, and most businesses love it because they're the ones that ask us to send it. But if you don't have somebody to answer that phone or to give you the license, your business is going to come to a grinding halt.
I want to pick up on what you said, the desire of the conservative members of the House of Representatives, where all budget bills begin in Congress, want to cut everything but the war. Part of the deficit that we have was brought about beginning when George Bush became president in 2000. At that time, when President Clinton left, the budget was balanced. There was actually a surplus.
Yeah, we got there. Let me back up a little bit historically. But when Clinton came before Congress and said we have to balance the federal budget, he had a plan. And the plan was we're going to have to cut a lot out. And stop doing some of the things we're doing and modernize a lot of government. And also, we're going to have to raise some new revenues. And when these revenues come in, instead of spending them, we're going to earmark them to pay off the debt. We passed that on just Democratic votes. There was not a single Republican vote. And there was a tie in the Senate. And Al Gore was vice president at the time. He had to come in as a member of the Senate and cast the deciding vote so that the president could sign the bill. And it became law. And as you said, we ended up, before he left office, we were running a surplus, and George Bush came in and took that surplus and immediately said, I don't approve of those tax increases that you did during the Bush, during the Clinton administration. We're wiping those out. So the question is, well, then what are you going to do to pay off, other debts? Because we were trying to pay off the long-term debt at that point. And he didn't have any answer to that. So you took the revenue out. That cost us $1.3 trillion over 10 years. And then he, a few months later, decides that we're going to go into war. And the Congress asked him, well, Mr. President, how are you going to pay for it? And he said, well, we're not. We're just going to put it on the credit card. We'll pay for it later. So you had big, huge expenditures upon expenditures with no way to pay for them. And he didn't do anything fiscally conservative to cut anything. So the deficit, we just borrowed money. And the deficit got to an all-time high. The Republicans lost the election. Obama came in, and guess what? The deficit is... And misgivings on Wall Street because they'd stopped enforcing, being good police persons of Wall Street. And we saw what happened there. And all of a sudden, we had a brand new Congress, a new president. And the first thing we had to do is bail out the country. And all the economy said, if government doesn't spend a lot of money in a hurry, we'll end up in a total chaos here. We'll end up in a crash.
Do you think that's a true statement? We will end up in a crash?
Yeah. I mean, at that point, it was not a conservative economist versus a liberal economist. They were united in their indications that we were in deep financial trouble and that the world was going to get in deep financial trouble, and America had to lead by spending a lot of money, and that's why we approved the stimulus package. But remember, to the businesses that were on Wall Street, we loaned the money, or we bought stock, and as we did in General Motors, and then as they got back on their feet and their stock prices went up, we sold it and made some money. But I think almost most of all the TARP money, which was the last act of Bush to save Wall Street, has been paid back. The stimulus money was all borrowed money, and it hasn't been paid back yet because the economy hasn't improved. But we saved an awful lot of jobs. I know in my district, the contractors told me if it wasn't for the contracts they got from the government, they would have had to lay off hundreds and hundreds of more people. This is like Granite Construction and Granite Rock, which are two big construction companies that are in Watsonville.
Well, Sam Farr, I want to ask you more about the borrowed money, but before we get there, this is Radio Curious. We're visiting in this program with Congressman Sam Farr, who has been representing Monterey and Santa Cruz County in the United States Congress for 18 years. This is Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Sam, this is your ninth Congress.
Yes, sir.
So when you say we borrowed money, who do we borrow it from?
Well, you borrow it from the taxpayer. We borrow it by selling treasury bonds, and then those are essentially IOUs. People have, and we use the money from those sales to make payments.
What is the security of those treasury bonds? What backs it?
The full faith and credit of the federal government, which is all the wealth of the nation.
Is that a good investment?
The number one investment there is. When everybody says you've got to bail out of everything, the one thing they say is move your money into treasury bonds. I mean, they are the most secure instrument in the market.
So how would that affect inflation?
It's a good question, Barry. At one point, people were paying us. We had negative interest on them. We wouldn't pay you anything. And people were buying them even if they got no money or less money back, because they were the most secure thing out there.
In other words, they wouldn't go down in value other than the lost interest or the forepaid interest.
Yeah, I mean, it's backed by essentially Americans' economic well-being, and we're still the strongest economic engine on the planet.
Let's talk about foreign intrigue. You just returned from a trip to Indonesia, where the religious philosophy is significantly different among some people than in the United States. What did you observe? What's going on there?
Well, Barry, we went there because we have a committee in Congress that I'm on. I'm very proud of. It's a House Democracy Committee, and what it does is work with parliamentarians in other countries to try to improve their parliamentary skills, most internally having good staff and having good independent information. It's essentially kind of a Peace Corps that does congressional professional building work, and we visited with the Indonesian Parliament, which is very interested in this program. And then we visited East Timor, which is one of the poorest countries in the world, and because their parliament's been working with us as well. But what really struck me, I mean, Indonesia, we know so little about it other than that's where Bali is, but it is the fourth largest country in population in the world, and it is the largest Muslim country in the world. They're very pro-West, although what we picked up was the media has done throughout the Muslim world has played a lot the fact that we've got people in this country that think burning the Quran is some kind of a smart thing to do, and that this nation seems to oppose any mosque being built in New York. And so there is a big growing fear or thought that Americans are very anti-Muslim, and that if Muslims come to this country, they would get in trouble.
What is the position of the few Muslim members of Congress? How are they treated?
No, I don't think they're treated any differently. I think when this kind of House Un-American Activities Act, where we started, the Republicans started looking at Muslims being something we ought to fear, that rose to everybody that I know. I mean, we were so aghast that activity was going on because the message it was sending around the world, it was far more negative than anybody intended.
And that message is?
That America seems to be anti-Muslim in official capacity, not just in, you know, small hate groups.
Well, how do you compare that statement, whether or not you believe it, to the wars that are going on in which the U.S. is involved in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Libya?
Well, I think that's why I think this entrance into Libya had to be so cautionary, because of fear that there would be another sign in the Arab world that this is the third Arab country that America is invading. And it just plays on the enemy's ability to make America seem as an anti-Muslim country, and therefore not only anti, but hating Muslims, and therefore a good reason for everybody to hate us.
So President Obama sent aid to the rebels in Libya without contacting Congress, without getting congressional approval. There's some dislike of that among members of Congress. Talk about that.
Well, it's on both sides of the aisle, but I've been in Congress long enough where we got mad at Clinton for going into Haiti. We got mad at and doing some actions in Bosnia-Herzegovina. We're certainly upset with Bush going into Iraq and Afghanistan, although there was a resolution on that. And I think we were disappointed that the president didn't come and ask us.
Had he asked, what would you have said?
He was in tough. I don't know whether he would have gotten it. I mean, the liberals don't like war and wouldn't approve it, and the Republicans don't like anything that Obama's doing, and they would disapprove it. So there may have been enough votes to defeat it.
And then what?
But then he would. Well, then he probably couldn't do it. I mean, he couldn't go forward without because Congress appropriates the money. You can't vote against the war and not withdraw the money. So I think he was in a very precarious position. I mean, if you want to argue on one side that thank God the United States is stepping forward when civilians are being slaughtered. I mean, where were we in Darfur? Where we were in Rwanda? Many people thought we should have given military aid to those issues, and we didn't. And I think Obama feels that that is a proper role for America to play, a humanitarian one, but it's a new role. And right now, I don't think he wants to ask for permission because he might not get it, and that certainly would give a negative sign to our NATO allies who are involved now, and certainly give a negative sign to our men and women in uniform. But more importantly, that by next Friday, if we don't pass another continuing resolution or adopt a budget for the rest of this year, we're going to have no way to pay anybody in this country, and it'll be even worse than voting against the, I don't know what we're calling the Libyan exercise or whatever they're calling it.
And that's Friday, April 8th.
Yeah, it's the next Friday.
So only Congress can declare war. The last time Congress declared war was in 1941, in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Yet there's been a lot of war going on.
Certainly. It was the Korean conflict, as they called it. We were, it was a UN joint, what we essentially was us, fell on us. Vietnam, that was our venture. I didn't have a lot of allies in Vietnam. Certainly have had them in Iraq and Afghanistan, but been principally Americans. And I think there's a concern here that, you know, we don't feel that we ought to be the 911 for every time there's a conflict in the world that we have to send troops to resolve it. I mean, we really ought to be doing this diplomatically. That's why this roadmap to peace in the Middle East is so much more important than anything else. But seems to be taking a back seat every time Netanyahu or Palestinian Authority or anybody tries to get anything done.
Well, Sam Farr, member of Congress from the 17th Congressional District in California, Monterey and Santa Cruz counties, I want to thank you for being with us. This is probably the seventh or eighth time over the 21-year history of Radio Curious. But tell me about a eureka or an aha moment that you've had at some point in your experience and how it sticks with you.
Well, I think it was an aha moment, and it was curious because I'm very keen on ocean policy and the healthy ocean. I think the ocean's dying, and I think the planet's going to die if we don't save the ocean. And so one of the things that really hit me in East Timor, having been a former Peace Corps volunteer, was how this country, one of the poorest in the world, could not have all that plastic garbage on their beaches. They couldn't have produced it. They don't have the money to buy any of the stuff that's on the beaches there, and it just... My God, you know, the garbage of the world is really washing up on shores of countries that are at pretty pristine shorelines. And what a shocking revelation that was at how small the planet is when it comes to ocean trash. It just heightened my interest in trying to have this campaign to stop ocean pollution.
And how about radioactive pollution of the oceans off of Japan?
Well, and you know, we have radioactive pollution off the Farallon Islands in California because we dumped a lot of radiological waste in barrels that have been rotten down there. I think we've now cleaned them, gotten them out of there, but they were leaking radioactive material. So Japan isn't the only one to fault that, and obviously we have some big issues if we had a tsunami of that type on the California coast with San Onofre and Diablo Canyon nuclear power plants that are very vulnerable to earthquakes.
Well, considering you've been in Congress now for 18 years, what would you like to do with the remainder of your one precious life?
Oh, I'd like to have world peace and prosperity. I'm still fighting. I got into politics because I wanted to eliminate the culture of poverty, which essentially is generated by three things: not a safe place to sleep, not access to education, and not having access to health care. And those are still huge battles to be fought here in America. When everybody has access, we won't have people, we'll still have poor people, but we won't have a culture of poverty where you don't have a chance to get out of it. Once you give people a chance, then there's opportunity. And in this country, people have done very well by getting out of poverty, but we've got to do a lot to help with that, because that isn't going to be done by the private sector.
Well, that takes us back to where we came in about the budget.
Well, the budget, I think we're going to have a lot of hurt before the country wakes up and sees that there are choices to be made. And it seems like this new gang in town is making a lot of wrong choices that are hurting a lot of people. But I don't think it gets people understand this until they can see it. And unfortunately, that's after the damage has been done.
Do you still have hope?
Yeah, I think I'm an optimist. I always have been. I have grandchildren, and I certainly want to make sure that the world is a better place for them. And I even though I get discouraged, I don't have any options, because if you don't fight for it, it'll never happen.
Well, Sam, is there a book that you can recommend to our listeners?
Well, it's nice that you asked. Barry Vogel, a returned Peace Corps volunteer from Peru, as I recall, and because I'm reading, you know, it's the 50th anniversary of the Peace Corps, and I just picked up a book called When the World Calls. That's the inside story of the Peace Corps in its first 50 years by a guy named Stanley Meisler, and I really enjoyed it.
Well, Congressman Sam Farr, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you very much.
Sam Farr is a member of Congress representing the 17th Congressional District, which is Monterey and Santa Cruz counties on the central coast of California. The book that he recommends is When the World Calls, The Inside Story of the Peace Corps and Its First 50 Years by Stanley Meisler, M-E-I-S-L-E-R. This interview was recorded on April 3rd, 2011. All editions of Radio Curious are free for anyone, anywhere, to listen, download, and enjoy. There are about 400 archive editions on our website, www.radiocurious.org. You may subscribe to our podcast at our website. Our email is curious@radiocurious.org. Snail mail is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, U-K-I-A-H, California, 95482. And the phone is 707-462-6541. You've been listening to Radio Curious. Christina Onestad is the associate producer. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.